Welcome to Story of a Storyteller. I'm your host, Connor Braden. This is the show where I found out all about the ins and outs of the lives of storytellers of all kinds. You can find my free novella, The Stolen Dagger, episode show notes, links to all sorts of amazing books, and more at connorbraden.com/podcast. Enjoy! Hello, story lovers, and welcome to Season 3 of the podcast. I'm very excited to have the wonderful Anna Massacat on the show today. Anna is a born storyteller. With a history in film and video game writing, is it any wonder that she eventually made her way to novels? She is the author of Behind Blue Eyes and its recently released sequel, Behind Blue Eyes 2, Fallen Angels, both of which are in the cyberpunk subgenre of sci-fi. And if you don't know what that is, don't worry, Anna has you covered. She explains it in this interview. Anna tells me all about her childhood growing up in Bavaria in Germany. She was born in Poland, actually, and kind of remembered a couple of years behind the Iron Curtain, as she called it herself. We talk about why her family moved, and when she was only six, they moved to Bavaria, and how that affected her life in general. It's a great interview, and I'm delighted that I had the chance to talk to the wonderful Anna. In other news, I've been working quite hard on improving things in the background of my little podcast writing career, and things are much more streamlined now. Writing-wise, it was a bit weird for a while. I had too many ideas and not enough time to do any of them, so I kept trying to decide, well, which is the best one? And as a result, I basically had analysis paralysis, or paralysed by choice, however you want to call it. However, I listened back to a lot of the advice that past guests gave, and I just said, you know what, I just have to write something. So the first thing I did was I wrote a children's picture book, which is very different to what I've done so far, I know, but sure, look. I'm hoping to start sending it out to publishers soon, and we'll see how that goes. Then I just reflected on the past two seasons, and to be honest, I was inspired by Stephen Black and Halo Scott from season one, and Dixon Rule, or Eve Power, from last season as well, and Anna, this very episode as well. I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to go for it and get the next three books in the series that started with The Longest Night. Enough sitting around, enough doing nothing. Anyway, that's it from me, so let's hear from Anna. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of, I should say the opening episode of season three of Story of a Storyteller, the podcast where I get to talk to storytellers and find out about their life and what makes them who they is. And my first guest of season three is Anna Massacat. Hello.
Hi, Connor. I'm so excited that you invited me and that I'm first guest of the new season. That makes it even more exciting and better. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Not at all. It's such a joy and a pleasure to have you. And I was getting you on because you have your book Behind Blue Eyes, and now you have the sequel of it coming out. Well, it just came out yesterday when we were recording this, but it's going to be out for a little while once this airs. But what I didn't realize, Anna, is that you don't just have those books. You have the MUC series, and then you have some written in German, but you also are part of award-winning films, and you worked with video games. It just seems like storytelling has been your jam, and you've always been doing it, so it's great to get you on. So before we start talking about all those little bits and bobs, I'd like to know about little Anna, because you have all this experience of telling stories, but were stories a big part of your childhood growing up?
So I was, as my parents are telling me, and basically everyone in the family, I was a very exceptional child, because I learned speaking very quickly and reading also before I went to school. And I basically was a storyteller since I started speaking. So I was totally not interested in, I don't know, building Lego and stuff like that. I was totally into stories from the beginning. So until I learned to read myself, my mom had to read to me all the time. And then I was telling the stories she read me to other people. And apparently I was able to memorize them really well. Oh, wow. Nobody was ever surprised I would go in this direction, because that came basically when I started thinking. So that was that. And then later, I funny thing is that before I started really writing, like short stories and that kind of stuff, everybody starts out with, I started making films. So my dad bought this camera back in the 80s and, you know, like one of those. And, you know, I just brought in the whole neighborhood and everybody had to play in my awesome films I made. So, yeah.
Did they have a choice?
I'm sure.
Did they have a choice in being in these films, or were you like, no, you're there, you're this character, move, action?
Basically, yes, that was how it was. So all the neighborhood children and my friends from elementary school and so on, they all got involved if they wanted or not, and sometimes also their parents. So yeah. that was me in elementary school. So I unfortunately nothing of this stuff exists anymore. It was VHS, and it's really unfortunately, because it would be hilarious to see any of it.
Do you or your parents still have the actual physical VHS tapes?
No, uh-oh. They don't.
Because I only ask because that's actually a total sidebar, but this is a conversation. That was something I did for my parents as a Christmas present one year. I was home before Christmas and I took all our home videos that were all recorded directly into VHS, and I brought them to this like digital archive kind of center, and basically hand them in, and for a fee they'll transpose them, I suppose, onto DVDs or onto USBs or whatever you need. And it was so nice.
Yeah, my parents did that actually. It was a lot of stuff they had, but for some reason all my stuff is gone. You know, maybe I destroyed it when I was a teen. I don't remember, you know.
Yeah.
And when I was a teen, I probably was so embarrassed. I said, okay, nobody is ever allowed to see this. Bam. That would have been me, pretty typical for me back then. So maybe I did that to myself. I really don't know. So yeah, that was it. And then I basically started writing when I was a teen. Then there was the phase where I started writing, you know, short stories and poetry and that kind of stuff everybody starts out with. And that's what it is. So my life basically was destined to be as it is from day one.
Day one, yeah. You said earlier, as soon as you started thinking, so instead of I think, therefore I am, you're I think, therefore I am, telling stories.
Yes, really, because for me, I always say for me, it's really like breathing. I can't live without being creative every day. For me, this is essential. It's the most essential thing. You know, I can go with without food for 2 days. That's okay for me. But I can't go without being creative.
Yeah.
And that's really how I am. Yes.
And because I'm the same, like, I find if I go for a while without creating something in some way, before I started writing seriously, we'll say, with a view to it becoming my full-time career, I used to do a lot of stage acting, and
nice.
I found that if I went for longer than a year without auditioning or being in a play of some kind, I would start getting really down because I hadn't discovered other outlets of creativity. So how if you do go through a period of time, however long or short, without creating, does it affect you, and how does it affect you?
I get depressed.
Yeah.
I really get depressed. I am, for me, yeah. So if I can't do it on a regular basis, I basically get sick. So it's like,
you're right, because you have to. You just write because you have to.
yes. Or create. I mean, I wasn't always writing, but writing is what I now do enjoy most. But being creative is like, for me, just an essential thing.
Necessary.
Unfortunately, you know, I always say, I wish I could have become a lawyer or a doctor or something like that.
Hey.
I would be sitting in a big house and drive a Tesla. And now... look at me.
Bills would never be overdue. It'd be a huge house. You'd have someone to take the dogs out for a walk instead of barking during interviews. Like, it'd be great.
Well, nobody would interview me. So why would you interview some lawyer? I mean, they're the most boring people in the world. Sorry, lawyers. They're nice lawyers. My lawyer is great. Okay.
You say that, but I have someone lined up for the next season who is a part-time lawyer and a part-time writer. So They can be, lawyers can be nice too, but not always.
Yeah, they can be people. That's true.
Yeah, we'll let them. I'm surprised most of them aren't androids or cyborgs anyway, which we'll get to that. Don't worry. So I know, and I'm asking this because I have personal interest, because I kind of went through the same thing-ish. I know that you were born in Warsaw, and then when you were around six or so, your family moved to Munich. And I told you, and you didn't believe me when I said it. You're like, what? When I was five, we moved from New York here back home, as we said it. So what was that like as a six-year-old? Do you have a lot of memories of Poland, or is kind of, is Munich home? Like, what do you think of as home when you're thinking of, I'm going back home to see my folks or whatever?
So home is, for me, is Munich and Bavaria in particular. I didn't grow up in Munich. I grew up in a small town close to Munich, and the part of Germany is called Bavaria, and that's basically the part everybody knows. When you think of Germany, you think of Bavaria, because that's the mountains and the beer and the beer gardens and everything that's nice and pretty, that's there. So Bavarians would really like to get rid of the rest of Germany, because they are, you know, that's, so that's Bavaria. That's where I grew up. And it wasn't always easy, because people are like that. But it's really, for me, when I think of home, that's that. And also my closest family lived there, my parents, my brother, and his wife and children. So that's for me the place to go home. But I also feel surprisingly still attached to Poland, and that's like a second home for me. I mean, I've visited often, even though my parents left when I was little, because the whole mentality of the people resonates with me very much, more than Germans actually, which is really interesting.
And are your parents, out of curiosity, because like the reason we moved is because my parents were Irish and had grown up in Ireland, and I was just about to really get settled into school and all that kind of thing. So they kind of moved back home. So are your parents German that were in Poland, or are they Polish that moved to Germany? Or
No, my parents are Polish, and why did they move? Because of communism. Okay. Like so many other people who left from behind the Iron Curtain and went someplace else. I mean, that so many people did that, because apparently life there wasn't so shiny and great as people would like us to believe. I still have memories of that time. I have my personal memories of living behind the Iron Curtain when I was a child, and those memories are very vivid actually. And later on, we've been visiting every year, and I have a lot of family living there, so I experienced this whole change that went on very, very closely actually.
Yeah. And do you look at, like, do you have first cousins that grew up? Yeah. So do you look at them kind of like in the sense of, wow, I grew up on one side of the curtain and they grew up on the other? Like, do you kind of ever think of them, comparing them and being like, thinking about the road that you didn't go down or anything like that?
I think no matter where my parents would have went, I probably would have ended up on the same road I am now. I don't think that I would have become someone different if I grew up in Warsaw. I am pretty sure I would have gone to film school there, or film school in Łódź, which is like the biggest, most prestigious one in Poland. So that's what I probably would have done. But of course, the life my cousins had was very, very different than mine when we were growing up. And the great thing to see is that they all made it. I mean, they all made a career, and they all are really well situated, and they all have children, and the children are doing really well. So after the whole change happened, everything went up for them.
Yeah.
And that's just great to see. You know, they really were able to get a better life out of it.
That's brilliant. Because, and on a sidebar, I'd say a lot of people outside of Ireland would know this. Polish is the second most spoken language in Ireland.
Because there are so many Polish people in Ireland?
Yeah.
Wow.
So when, I know. So when Poland joined the EU, I think I want to say 2004 or 2005. I remember just it feel like it happened overnight. There was just suddenly a lot of Polish, Latvian, Lithuanian, and Estonia would be the least common, we'd say, people moving to Ireland, because at the time Ireland had a booming economy, which we later discovered was a bed of lies because it crashed like everyone else did in 2008.
Like everywhere, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, and a lot of Polish people stayed, and now like their children are growing up here with Irish accents, and then they just get collected by their mom or dad and start speaking in Polish, and it's brilliant, it's wonderful, and it's great to see.
That's how it was with me too. Yes, I grew up bilingual,
natively bilingual. So you have Polish and German and English. So do you have any others?
I speak a little bit of French, but really just a little bit, just my school French. And I also speak a little bit of Thai, which I started learning because I like traveling to Thailand so much. But
that's the extent.
That's really difficult. That's really difficult. I will never write in that language.
Oh, you say that now. Give it another couple of years and I wouldn't be surprised.
So for now, I'm trying to get really, really good at English so I can. My goal is that hopefully one day I will just be able to write so people don't notice I'm not a native speaker. That's for me, that's the goal, and that's what I'm working on very hard. And I think it's getting better. Most of the time people don't even notice when I just write that I am not a native speaker. It's when I open my mouth and start talking, they realize, okay, I didn't expect that. So maybe my accent will vanish one day too. I would hope so, but
really, you want your accent to go?
Yes.
Oh, why?
I don't know, because it sounds, I think it sounds horrible. I don't know why people say it sounds nice. I really don't.
Oh man, no. Well, I suppose I like, to each their own. Everyone has their own opinion of their own accent, but I mean, I know I personally, I grew up on one side of the country of Ireland. I say one side, like you can travel from one coast to the other in less than 3 hours. So it's not big. Like, we're really small. But for such a tiny island, we have such a variety of accents. Like even some certain cities, like in Dublin, I can hear an accent and know what part of Dublin they are from. So accent, there's many accents in Ireland, and it bugs me. I hate losing my Leitrim accent, which is where I'm from, and it's merging into this Dublin accent because that's what I hear all the time. And it's funny, whenever I call my mother or my father on the phone, and I'll talk to them for like half an hour or something, and then I get off the phone, my partner is always like, ah, there's the Leitrim accent again, it's back.
I think Irish accents are lovely.
Well, we don't, but we're very aware everyone else thinks we have nice accents, so we just kind of, we're just riding that wave.
You can.
You mentioned that a second ago that you probably would have ended up going to film school no matter where you grew up. And I did want to go to that. What was it about film school that called, like, what was it about film? So obviously you grew up and you were, I know you said you were making films as a kid, but what is it about the storytelling, I don't want to say genre, method of film that attracts you so much to it, especially in your earlier years?
It's the visual thing. So I even though I work with words, I'm more of a visual person actually. So I see, when I write a book, people always tell me that my books are very cinematic, and that's because I create a movie first in my head, like precise movie, and I write it down. So it's not just that I really see it like an edited movie with the cuts at the right places and so on. And especially when I write action scenes or stuff like that, I see stuff in slow motion and so on. So I basically create movies and then translate them into books. So for me it was a really very logical step to go in that direction, because the visual aspect, telling a story with visuals, with images, that was what fascinated me most, and it still does, right? I mean, it was like my first love, and so So going to film school was for me a big dream and a logical thing to do. And I was very, very happy that I achieved that. Also, I studied screenwriting at film school, not directing, which I wanted originally. But yeah, it doesn't really matter what you do. Once you're in there, you will go on.
I'm sure though, like other colleges specific for things like that, that even if you do specialize in, we'll say, screenwriting or directing or editing, you still get a good experience of all the branches anyway, like more so than you would somebody who doesn't go to film school.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So would you, having finished film school, maybe when you left film school, I don't want to say fully qualified, but you know, when you left and you've done your degree or your certificate, I don't know what it would be called, were you happy that it was screenwriting you ended up with, or was there another branch you're like, oh, I wish I was more involved in that?
So I made short films before I even went to film school. The screenwriting thing was also combined with a scholarship, which was really great. So they paid me for going to film school, which was a nice thing, and also why I went into this direction. And it's also that they only have, you know, they only have 10 places every year for,
wow,
for all Germany. Yes. So this is a pretty big thing there. It's not like in America where you can study film at every college. There are only a couple of film schools in the whole country, and they only take 10 candidates for each each specification a year. So there are usually 10 screenwriters, 10 directors, 10 producers, 10 cinematographers, that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay, so it's 10 of each branch, and then they,
yeah, maybe it changed, I don't know, I mean it has been 20 years ago. Yeah. So that was how it was back then. And once you're in there, it is like it's like one mafia, you know, when you're inside, you can branch out wherever you want. And for me, and ironically, after that, I went into producing. I started producing films, short films mostly, and some commercials. So I got another scholarship for production, and an office at Bavaria Film Studios. And I sat there and produced films with a little company I had with two friends.
Oh, wow.
So, and I was 25. So it was a crazy time.
And I know that you then, some of the work you did then around that time ended up winning awards. Is that correct?
Well, we won a couple of awards with the short films. I also directed short films. So that was what I liked doing most. And I made a short film, which was a horror film on a submarine. And so we went with this film all over the world to festivals, and then you win awards. And that's how it goes. You just need that kind of stuff. So you get prestige, and then people give you money for more films you want to do. That's just how the whole industry works.
And because you're kind of already answering my next question, but I'm going to rephrase it. So I think within novelists, we'll say, and authors and writing and stuff like that, there is this kind of, it's not really discussed that much, but I see it, and I'm sure you have too, there's a kind of a divide about awards, as in, like, the divide is, are they important or are they not? And then kind of parallel to that, there's also a discussion of, are they worth anything? Like if book A wins an award and book B doesn't, there'll be some people who say, well, that means book A is better, but there'll be some people who say, no, book B and book A are equal. So as someone who has won awards, like, what's your opinion on them? Do you place value in them? Do you place stock in them? Or are you kind of like, ah, whatever?
Well, that's actually a topic I really like, because in the film industry we have a saying, and that's awards are like hemorrhoids. Every a-hole will get them eventually.
Brilliant. Okay.
Enough said. Okay. So I think that's what awards are. Awards, almost never are like awards go almost never go to a book or a movie or something like that, which is outstanding and better than the rest. So it's always almost always a political thing. It's always who you know and what you do and why, and if it's kind of something certain people want to have promoted, and that's how you get the awards or don't get them. And so I would give this as an advice to authors who are sitting out there and looking at other authors and think, oh my God, they're so much better than I. They have won this, 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 and this, and I am sitting here. And don't worry, they're not better than you. And there are also awards, like for example, in science fiction, the Nebula Award, and so on. They are only for traditional published authors, you know. So I couldn't even enter there if I wanted, and they have their people they want to get those awards, and if you have a publisher, it's much easier in general. I also got awards with my novels and back in Germany. It's like it goes. I was with a big publisher, and when the big publisher goes in there and throws your book into the race, your standing is much, much different. And that's just how it goes. So I wouldn't worry about it. And to be honest, I'm not even sure if you look at books, if an award-winning book, if it would sell better than one that has nothing. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah,
honestly, I don't think so.
I mean, the way I look at it there with what you just said, I don't think I've ever been in a shop, or either digital or in our brick and mortar shop, and looked at two books. And let's say I only have enough money for one. If I'm looking at two books and I'm really trying to decide, I'm going to pick the one I think I'll like better. I'm not going to pick the one that has an award and the one that over one that doesn't. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I, as a reader, I never look to see how many awards does a book have, you know? Having said that, You do notice when you flip it over and the whole book is just covered in five star, five star, five star, five star from like loads of different reviews and like awards, 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 awards. But that wouldn't tip me over the edge to buy it. Would you be the same?
I think, you know, the kind of people who are really into books and really into stories, they are not, they are like you and me also. I would choose the book. I probably would choose the book critics don't like, because usually what critics like are not, is not good, you know?
Yeah.
They are, so no, I won't say this, because maybe sometime, maybe a critic will hear it and then they will burn me. No, we also have a saying about critics in the movie industry, but I will tell you then one way on off air, you will like that one too.
Okay. I will judge if it's good enough, and I'll say it at the end of the interview then for everyone else.
No. It's between us.
Okay.
I think there are also the kind of people who go into Barnes and Nobles like once a year, and they will just buy the books on the bestseller table. And
yeah, you're right.
So on, right? And that's also, there are certain books on the bestseller list, and they're the kind of books where people go there on Christmas or because grandma has birthday, and then they go there and look and see, oh yeah, so there is the biography of XYZ. this guy, and oh, I know grandma likes him, let's buy the book. So that's how it goes. And those books are not read. I mean, they end up somewhere in a shelf or in a box. Yeah. So many of the bestsellers are actually not being read, especially the ones coming from the bookstores. So,
and when you say that, I mean, recently enough, well, I say recently, this is like in the last 12 months or so. I think it was Donald Trump Jr., like the son, he wrote a book and it got on the New York Times bestseller list. But then it turned out it's because he bought like hundreds of thousands of them himself, so that it would get onto the New York Times bestseller list. And
they all do that. I mean, yeah. that's something they just pulled him out because it's always cool to pull one of them out, you know. But that's a common practice. So he basically did nothing what all the others wouldn't do either. That all the guys with their biographies like that push them into the best-selling list, they buy their books and the publishers buy the books. I mean, that has been a common practice for like forever.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's funny, of course, But it doesn't surprise me. So
So we're just going to take a total different direction just for a moment, just because I have someone I can talk to about this. As far as I'm aware, you're my first guest in the show that is an avid lover of video games. And I mean, my Twitter handle is Connor the Geek. I mean, if people don't know I like video games, you're not paying close attention. I was going to tell you a short story. Basically, I remember, I mentioned it before we started recording, actually. I remember playing Final Fantasy VII as a young enough kid. And I was enthralled. Like, it was sucking me in. And I remember telling my friends who weren't gamers, like, every day, I'd be like, oh, last night I did this, and then this happened, and then the back. And like, I was telling them, like, as if it was this book I was reading. And I remember having a debate with a friend. I'm not going to say argument, a debate when we were older in reference to that game, saying that video games are an art form in the same way screenwriters would consider films an art form, that novels are an art form, that painting. So would you agree? Do you think video games are an art form? And can you, if anyone's listening and think I'm crazy, tell them why they're wrong?
100%. Of course. Absolutely. They are an art form and they're fantastic. And I don't know, people who say they are not, they have just no idea. I mean, to produce a video game, there are so many amazingly talented people working together to make this possible. I mean, you have artists, you have game writers, you have game designers, you have level designers, you have concept artists, you have video artists,
you have actors. And there are, you even have actors, like,
yes, you have voice actors, you have composers. I mean, it's incredible. And for me personally, the guys, the gods, are the ones who are writing the code, the coders, the ones who write the source code and everything of a game. Those are magicians. Those guys are incredible. I worked in the video games industry and I met all the kind of such people. And for me, the coders are the most amazing ones. I absolutely love what I do. It's because for me, it's unimaginable. Really is not. I've seen what they do firsthand, and for me, I still don't understand it. I have no idea what they do, honestly. So,
you type the thing, and now he can jump over the box. Like, how does that? Yeah,
yeah, right. You see them writing code. I mean, I still don't understand it. Honestly, I don't. They explained it to me so many times, and I just felt like an idiot. But
I know my
they liked me because I took them into goth clubs, so it was awesome.
That's okay.
So I took all the little nerd guys and took them into gothic clubs, and sometimes they got lost.
But you know what? That's okay.
I know one guy, so I took him. He was a coder and he was like short guy and really timid. So we went to this goth club and I made him drink. And he ended up on a park bench somewhere in the city with two goth chicks taking care of him. This is the best story ever. And he was the hero after that. He was the hero in the whole company with all other nerds. He was the man. He said, so I started worrying because he was gone at some point and I didn't hear from him until Monday. And then he was back to work and I said, okay, what happened to you? And then he like beamed and told me the whole story. So I don't know what happened, but I woke up on a park bench and there were two ghost chicks taking care of me and I had no idea who they are.
So yeah, he's having the time of his life. He was loving life.
Yeah, absolutely. He will never forget that. I mean, yeah.
And that's all thanks to you. So look at that. Giving back to video games. One nerd at a time.
That was me. That was me in the video game industry. Me and the nerds.
And what kind of games did you work on when you were working in the video game industry, or what studios did you work with?
So I worked at a studio that produces shooters, and later at a studio that produces strategy games.
Okay.
And I was one of the game writers for the strategy game, and it was definitely a fun experience, but it's very, very different kind of writing than like screenwriting or novels. So it's way more, you're way more bound into certain ways, into certain boundaries, how you work and how everything has to look and so on. So for me, it it just wasn't so much my thing. So that's why I my next step was then to start publishing novels after that. But I really liked the people working there. That was fun.
And we are going to talk about novels next, don't worry. But to stick with video games for a second, what would you like, what for you would be the all-time greatest video game that you have played? It's a very easy question.
Easy question, you think?
No.
I think my all-time favorite game is The Elder Scrolls Morrowind, when it first came out, like 2000 or something.
Yeah.
For me, it was mind-blowing. You know, this game was like, so I've never seen something like that before. It was so good, so great. Now you look at it and you think, what, I played that? There wasn't even a fast traveling system. But I was running for dozens of hours somewhere to the countryside and attacked, and then a monster killed you and then you spawned and had to run again. I mean, that was crazy. Nobody would do that now.
No.
But probably for me, one of my all-time favorite games that brought me very much into gaming was Monkey Island.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So that was, I played that so many nights, and you know, now you just, when you get stuck somewhere, now you just Google. But then, back then, there was no Google. No. Imagine that there was a time without Google. So if you got stuck in such a game, you had to figure it out by yourself. So that's what I did. I can proudly say I played through the whole game without any help.
Congratulations, because that is hard.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Because I remember, I had a Game Boy, and there was Super Mario Land, which was the first Mario Game Boy game, and I just got so badly stuck on the final boss, and there was no saving in that game. When you turn the Game Boy off, you had to start again from level one, world one, whatever. And
I remember that. Oh my god,
it was so, to get to the end of the game, you had to play for hours, and I used to do it all the time, and then I'd get to the final boss and I couldn't beat him. And there was this thing of, well, I can't save and walk away and come back. But there was, I don't know if you remember this, Nintendo used to have these phone lines that you could call, and there'd be like an expert on the other line. And you'd be like, yeah, I'm playing Super Mario Land and I'm on level 12 and I just can't beat, the boss's name was Tatanga. I was like, I can't beat Tatanga.
I remember that one.
Yeah. And he was just like, oh yeah. If you go over four tiles and up one, there's an invisible block there and you won't get shot. Like, that was someone's job once, to answer the phone and help kids with video games. It's nuts. So that's what we had to do. Anyone 20 or under, we had to phone official company lines or just figure it out.
I figured it out by myself. I also played all the Mario games. I also had a Game Boy, and I actually started playing games on the C64. So that was my first gaming console. The games back then, you know, it was just a mess of pixels, but yeah, it was fun.
You were a kid. And like now, I mean, we're talking on the 26th of March. On the 25th, the BAFTAs had, and we were talking about awards as well, the BAFTAs do a video games BAFTA ceremony as well. And like, if I feel like anyone who hasn't played video games in a while needs to sit down and play games like The Last of Us or Uncharted or God of War, or these huge games that are visual, like you were talking about being a very visual person with your film and stuff. They're visually beautiful, the music is astounding, the acting is phenomenal, the writing. And then behind all of that, you have the nerds who get to meet goth chicks on a park bench making the whole thing. So anyway,
I feel like it's amazing.
We could talk about video games for
time. Absolutely. We can talk about that. So just one more question. Did you play Cyberpunk 2077?
I haven't gone near it yet. It's but because I only let myself, because that was kind of how I was going to build into Cyberpunk in general.
So, perfect, huh?
I know. See, it's almost like somebody wrote these questions and planned a conversation ahead of time.
almost like scripted reality.
I know. So Cyberpunk 2077 is a video game that came out, what, is it 2-3 months ago now?
I think December.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a good while ago now. But it was interesting. It had a bit of controversy when it came out, as there was a lot of bugs a lot of people experienced and everything, but it also was hailed as a phenomenally good game, and the customization you could do with your characters and the world and everything. But I'd like to go back to just the word cyberpunk. For anyone who hasn't heard that before, could you make an attempt at defining it?
That's what people are discussing all the time, cyberpunk authors with each other, and
what is and what isn't.
People in forums and stuff are discussing this all the time. What is cyberpunk? And I can only tell you what it is for me, because everybody will define it differently. For me, it is a subgenre of science fiction, which is set in an urban setting on Earth, which is not in space or something like that. There are no aliens, and usually there are no aliens and such. And it has a lot to do with, it's very often dystopian, and has to do with body modifications and AI and that kind of stuff. So basically, personally for me, this question where the human stops and the machine starts and vice versa is a very, very important one for this genre. And my personal favorite of the genre is Ghost in the Shell, and the original anime from 1995. For me, this is what brought me to cyberpunk, and I think it's a masterpiece and great inspiration for my own work. Others will disagree. They say there is only William Gibson, but I personally prefer the Japanese interpretation of cyberpunk to our Western one.
Yeah, I think as well, one thing I read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep before I watched Blade Runner, which it's the same thing. It's a very long film title, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. I think for me, and I don't know if you'd agree or not, with cyberpunk there always has to be a bit of grit. Like, the world isn't perfect. It's a little bit, I don't want to say dirty, but it's you said it's in an urban environment. So there's a kind of an air of a lack of nature. And it's urban, but it's very urban. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's no trees on the streets in a cyberpunk setting.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, not necessarily, but it goes in that direction. So the cliche, of course, is like, it's always raining and dark and stuff. Yeah. That's like what everybody brings in their cyberpunk stuff. I wanted to do something different. So actually in the city, it's called Olympia City, which is the setting of my book. What they did is they wanted to create, they created a fake utopia. So they have trees, they have beautiful parks, they have, okay, everything is all shiny and pretty, and it's also set in the south, so it's the sun is always shining, and it's really, so this is the kind of world they have created, but that's only on the outside, because the grid is on the inside, and it's really, really big.
That's really interesting. So your cyberpunk series is Behind Blue Eyes, which, for anyone watching the YouTube video, you will notice that Anna has very blue eyes, but in contacts, which is such a good idea.
What are you talking about? Those are not contacts.
Sorry, they're not contacts. They're implants, I suppose.
Exactly. My cybernetic prosthetic eyes.
So what is, but could you tell us a little bit about what Behind Blue Eyes is about, and at what point did you decide to start writing it? Like, was it just novels, you always wanted to write a novel, or was it you were reading so much cyberpunk and then you were like, you know what, I can do this?
That's a story I wanted to write for a long, long time, actually. I had the basic idea for it, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, something like that. And yeah. and I never did it because first, I was in the film industry, and back then to even come up with a cyberpunk setting and say that's the movie I want to make, everybody would have said you're crazy. So you had to start out with lower budget stuff. That's why I went into horror, because it's much easier to produce. Anyway, so I had the basic idea for a long time, and then finally I decided to write it in 2019, and it turned out this is my favorite. I have written many books and screenplays and all kinds of stuff, and this is my very favorite one of everything I have done. So I say this is basically my life work. This book is all my experience, and everything I have ever done went into this book. Wow. And so it's very important to me. And what is it about? It's like I said, this Olympia City is it's an utopia. Everybody thinks so. It's a utopia. The only problem with it is if you disagree with this utopia, they will send killer cyborgs at your door, and they will kill you. So, and here you can see this is one of them. This is Nephilim, and Nephilim is the main character of the story, and the heroine. And she's a killer cyborg. She and her people are killing people who disagree or who try to escape this perfect society and start out in little villages or something and live a basic life, you know. Mm. Because when you have this kind of perfection where you can basically achieve whatever you want, there will be people who say, but I just want to I don't know, grow my own vegetable and raise my own children. So that's the kind of people they kill, because they can't allow any proof of an alternative lifestyle that it's possible, because then they would lose control. And that's what the setting is about. And then Nephilim, she starts doubting the whole system and eventually decides to take a stand against it.
One thing you said there, and I think it's really interesting, is the idea of a utopia, but if you disagree, you know, you're going to be assassinated. Which, to me, if you just take that out of it, it sounds like a dictatorship or a dystopia. And mm-hmm. that's something I think if you read any utopian or dystopian fiction, sometimes the line between a utopia and a dystopia can be very blurred. And I think it's a really interesting kind of just a concept to explore. So what is it like when you're creating, is it Olympia or Olympias City?
Olympias.
Olympias. So when you were creating Olympias City, was there anything about society that the world as you've experienced that you wanted to put in there in order to critique and to say this isn't right? Is there anything about society you put in there specifically?
So personally, I am a big fan of free will and free speech and that kind of freedoms, personal freedoms for people to be what they want to be and not what the society decides them to be. This is a very important point for me. It probably also has to do with that I grew up at least part of my life in an oppressive system where this wasn't possible, and then I witnessed it with all my family. So in this, and when I created Olympias, I created a system. I mean, it is the whole happiness there is basically fake, because the system is controlled by a corporation, which is the Olympias corporation, and it controls everything in every aspect of life. And but they pretend as if life would be better for everybody than it has ever been before, because they have eliminated everything that made human life miserable before. Mm. And the evil thing about this is that they do it to control people. So for me, I believe that people should be able to live their lives as they want, as long as they don't hurt anyone else. And that's the aspect there where they don't allow it just because they don't want anyone to live outside the system and outside what they believe is right, you know? And so it's a very, very... it's on the outside a very open lifestyle everyone has with a lot of personal freedoms, but in truth they are very, very limited.
So you can say it's like you're free within these rules that we have given you.
Yeah, and you're not allowed to disagree. That's the most important part about it. You know, you're free. You have everything. You can achieve everything. You can be whoever you want. You can change yourself. You can, I don't know, you know, make a career and whatever, consume all these nice shiny things. But as soon as you start doubting and maybe having your own thoughts which are not in line with the overall propaganda, you're basically dead.
Okay, yeah. So it's basically it's a very 1984-esque kind of
yes, thing. Like it is.
You can nearly say the cyborgs in your story are kind of like the thought police. Like they're once you disagree, they come down on you and boom, you're in trouble.
Yeah, when I created them, I had a little bit of like a cyborg Gestapo.
That's so
I mean they will kill you, will take you away, and then you will never come back. And they are extremely cool and extremely well dressed and so on. So
very fashionable, but lethal.
They are very, very lethal. Yes. Yes. I mean they have been designed to hunt humans. That's explained in a book why they are as they are, because as Metatron, the villain, explains it in book one, is that only a human mind can anticipate human behavior, which can be irrational. So if you really want to hunt humans, you can't use an AI, because AI is easily outsmarted. So what they do is they take the human mind and combine it with machine components and create like the perfect warrior. And those guys go and hunt humans, and humans stand no chance against them, no matter what they do.
I can't wait to read it. I said to you earlier, it's your book is get it. It's I've had it for so long. I bought it, I think about it ages ago, and it's just been like getting up and up and up in the to be read list. So I cannot wait to read it. So I don't want to ask you too many more questions. Because
I hope you enjoy it.
I know I will, because I've said this many times on the podcast and on Twitter. If it's a good story, I don't care what genre it is, because there's people out there, and I don't understand this as a reader, who they read one genre and one genre only. Like they only read romance, or they only read cyberpunk, or they only read stories that vampires are the main characters in. You know, like, which is fine. There's lots of ways to skin a cat, and there's lots of ways to be your reader. But that's not me. I want to taste a little bit of everything. You're a full-time author, and this is something I'd love to get to know a little bit more about. So at what point, what was the tipping point, I suppose, into deciding, you know what, I'm going to do this full-time?
I have been a full-time author all my life, actually. So, I mean, I did the other stuff in between. Like I had also my you know, my production company, and later I had when I was in the video game industry, they hire you full time, so you're basically an employee. But in the end, you can say that I have been doing this full time all my professional life. I never did anything else. I always say I'm completely useless. You know, if there would be a zombie apocalypse, I can't do anything. I can't do anything.
But you can tell a story.
I can tell you a story. I can create videos. I mean, I'm a pretty good video editor also. I do that on the side, create book trailers.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the kind of stuff I can do and I'm good at. But when it comes to, you know, real stuff, I'm completely useless, because I never learned anything like it. You know, I didn't, like most authors who have been lawyers or whatever in their first life, I was always, always this. I just jumped from one creative industry to the next, and kind of was living the dream a little bit. But of course, it's a very, very difficult way of life. This lifestyle is not for everybody, because I had everything from, you know, having the funds to have someone clean my apartment every week, to not knowing how to pay the rent. I had everything in my life, so it's just a very unstable world to live
in. A lot of ups and downs, and
yes,
like, you know, you're there's a phrase I hear a lot. You're only as good as your last book, and that's something I don't think a lot of people outside of writing realize, that it really does. I don't agree with the statement, don't get me wrong, but it's kind of more like, you know, if you need to pay the bills, you need to be selling books, and if you need to be selling books, you need to be creating books, and that's just the way things go. What do you think is the biggest challenge of being a full-time writer and doing, having the life you have? Like, what's the biggest challenge in that sense?
I think a big challenge is that you are the one responsible for everything. You know, you're really responsible for your life. If you don't sit down, if you don't create, if you don't evolve all the time, which is what I was doing, like, all my professional life, I never am at never stand still. I will always try evolving and get better. If you don't do that, you won't get anywhere. So I think that's a problem many people have, who, you know, had like a normal life and then start out. You don't have a boss who will tell you to sit down and write your book. You're your own boss, and you have to work really, really hard. I mean, I have been working extremely hard all my life. I mean, when I was 21, I started with my films. I first was at a university before I went to film school, but I already started with that. And, you know, most of my friends or people around me, they were just partying all the time, and I was working like crazy. I started with that very, very early, to work extremely hard. Okay, I did party too, a lot of partying, of course, but not like the typical person who goes to college, you know. That's just was a very different life. It was defined by extremely hard work, and that's what I do to the present day. I mean, I work really a lot, and that's just something you have to do. You know, other people are fortunate. There are authors who will write the first book and then it will become a bestseller, and then they basically made it, you know.
Yeah,
these stories happen, but they are extremely rare. So the experience I made in all the creative industries is that most people who are there and achieve something, they work extremely hard for it, and that's the downside, kind of, you know. It's not all shiny.
No, as much as we want it to be. Yes. So desperately want it to be, it's not all shiny.
Yes.
So we're getting to the end of time, and I don't want to keep you too long over it, so I'd love to know.
You don't I'm having a blast talking to you.
Oh, that's crazy.
So don't end it because of me.
I won't, don't worry. So what, let's say when we're all wrapped up and everything, what is the first thing you're going to do after you get up off the chair and have a little bit of a stretch? What's your next thing to do today?
So today I'm gonna have we scheduled a phone call with my narrator, who's working on Behind Blue Eyes and the audiobook, and we're gonna discuss a scene he was working on, and so this is basically the next thing for me on my calendar. And I am I talked about it before. I talk about it all the time, how excited I am about my audiobook. And so it's going to be there soon. And I am extremely lucky and happy that I found such a fantastic narrator to work on it with me.
That's brilliant. And I know that you because I listened to you on other interviews on other shows, that you found your narrator through Twitter, which is brilliant, because I think that's like, for a lot of writers, we're all there and we're all kind of saying, oh, I need to write, but instead here I am on Twitter. And we have to bear in mind that sometimes you make these professional connections through Twitter. I mean, I got to know you through Twitter, and actually most of the guests that I've had on the show I've met through Twitter. And it's nice to hear and see that people can get work done through Twitter too.
Yeah, absolutely. I see this work, you know. Yeah. For me, it is basically work. I don't have the time to engage in like talking nonsense. For me, this work, for me, it is like, of course, promotion, but also very, very importantly, making connections. But that's something I learned over the years. Like I brought that from my whole career, that, you know, making connections and making networking and so on, that's extremely important. And Twitter is a great platform for that. Mm. I mean, I met so many people over Twitter, also my whole, most of my circle, of my cyberpunk author circle, who we together we created the Cyberpunk Day and brought up anthology, yeah, and so on. So that I met most of them over Twitter. And with my narrator, yeah, he contacted me. I mean, his name is Sean Duriger, by the way, and he is absolutely brilliant, but I had no idea. It was just some person on Twitter, and it turned out he is an award-winning narrator, and now he's doing all my books. So sometimes you have to be lucky.
Yeah. But I suppose the thing is, you create your own luck. I mean, if you weren't on Twitter and if you weren't making connections, he wouldn't have. I'm sure it was just a friend of yours that retweeted your book, and then he got across it. And you know, that's the thing. You have to. The luck is definitely a part of it, but if you just sit back and do nothing, you're not going to be lucky.
So what he told me was that he noticed the marketing I do. I mean, I do a lot of stuff. I do all the trailers and a lot of visual stuff to promote my books. And that's how he got interested in the whole thing. And then he became a fan of Behind Blue Eyes. And that's why he didn't want to narrate it in the beginning. He just asked if you can help find me the perfect narrator. And I asked him, why don't you try it? And he actually didn't have any time for it. And he also doesn't really do royalty share anymore. But in this case, he said, yeah, okay. I mean, I like all the stuff you present out there so much. So let's do this.
Oh, wow.
So I think it's really worth it, you know, to just create your own brand and your own appearance you have with everything you do, and stick to it, and people will get you will get people's attention eventually.
Yeah.
And Twitter is a fantastic platform for that. I mean, Facebook sucks.
Yes, well, we all know about Zuckerberg and the android that he is.
Exactly. Us all.
Not a cyborg, everybody. He's an android. Big difference.
Yes.
So
he's not, he doesn't seem human enough to be a cyborg.
No. So I know that your second book in the Behind Blue Eyes series is out now, and I know that you have audiobooks on the way, but what is your, and I feel like I know what the answer is going to be, what is your big dream that, like, oh, wouldn't this be amazing if this happened, regards you and your writing?
Well, of course, I would be lying if I wouldn't say I want to sell as many books as possible. I think we all do, right? Yeah. So that's, for me, it's definitely a goal. I would like to bring my book to as many readers as possible, and I want them to really enjoy it. I think that's my big goal, and that's why I'm working so hard. Yes, if the more the merrier, right? I mean,
yes, definitely.
I think there are authors who just say, okay, I just do it for the art, and I just bring out my stuff, and I don't care.
Which is totally legit.
Definitely.
That doesn't have to be everyone's goal.
Exactly. For me, it is absolutely that I want to establish myself in the cyberpunk genre. And I want people to know my books and enjoy them and have a great time reading. That's the most important thing for me, is actually that they really like it, you know.
Brilliant. So. And Where can people find you online? I mean, obviously Twitter, we have sung its praises enough. So where else can people find you and your books online?
So I don't know, maybe you can put a link there.
Oh, there will be links. Yeah, definitely. Oh,
okay, a great opportunity or possibility to get in contact with me if someone wants to get in contact is to subscribe to my newsletter, because that's basically how I it's the most direct way how I communicate with my readers, and everyone can reply to my emails and I will reply to them. So that's probably the most personal way to get in touch with me. Otherwise, I'm on Twitter and on Facebook and on Instagram. I also have a YouTube channel. And the easiest way is open Amazon and type in Behind Blue Eyes, because my book will be the first one coming up on top.
Which is an achievement in and of itself. To be at the top of the list, it's amazing.
Yeah, so Behind Blue Eyes, that's where you find my book.
Excellent. And as you said, there'll be links to everything in Anna's website and everything in the show notes if you're listening on the podcast, and in the description there's a link to the blog post and everything will be there, including direct links to the books and everything. So it's all very
God, you're awesome.
Very
wow, that's really fantastic.
My final question, Anna, and we're going to say our goodbyes then, is what is the last book you read?
The last book I read was Dead Heads by Ross Young. Hey, so you know.
From season 2 of this show. So there you go.
Yes, you know each other and you probably know his book. And yeah, it's awesome. It's a great book. He's a great guy. He's a great author. And I truly enjoyed this book very much. I had a great time. And
Anna, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been so great to get to know you better, because we've been talking on Twitter for like 6, 7, 8 months now, and it's nice to actually get to know you a lot better. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I had a great time, and this was a very interesting conversation, and you asked me such interesting questions no one ever asked before.
Good. Yes.
So yeah, that was really awesome. Thank you very, very much. And I wish you all the best, like officially on air, because you know we were gonna talk. You. Anyway, and I will see whatever you're up to and can applaud it. So thank you very much, Connor.
Thank you.
Thanks once again to Anna for coming onto the show and for kicking season 3 off to such a gothy, cyborgy start. Be sure to tune in next week, as I had the most amazing experience of the podcast for myself personally so far. I got to interview one of my favourite all-time authors, Dennis E. Taylor, the author of the Bobbiverse saga. It was a brilliant experience, and you'll hear it. I'm just basically fanboying the entire time. So that's coming next week. Until then, chat to you all later. Thanks for listening today. I hope you loved listening to this episode just as much as I loved recording it. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or over on Podchaser. Until then, be good, be brave, and tell stories. See ya.